Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anna's Owl Ministries podcast.
Hello and happy spooky season, everyone. This is Systematic Geekology. We are the priest of the geeks, and we are here for another What's News episode where we talk about all the latest things in geek culture, and we're going to be talking about some upcoming things for the rest of the year, too. So I am very excited to be here. I am one of your geekologists, Kevin Schaefer, and I am joined here with my fellow co-host, the other kind of Marvel zombie, Andy Walsh. Andy, how are you today?
I am doing very well, Kevin. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's, you know, it's my favorite time of year. I love the Halloween season. I love all the movies coming out right now. And then a lot to look forward to. And we have a very, I love the lineup for this tonight. We've got, as you can see from the preview here, if you're watching on YouTube, we're going to be just going to be discussing a couple new movies, a new Marvel animated series. And because how can we not, Taylor Swift's new album. So we've got a lot to cover tonight. In addition to what's coming up for the rest of the year in all things culture. So I'm very excited. If it's your first time here, thank you so much for being here. We are glad to have you. And, you know, these are really fun episodes where we just kind of geek out, we talk about what's new. And yeah, we're really glad you're tuning in, whether you're live on YouTube or if you're listening to this later on one of our platforms. Thank you so much. And if you do like what you hear tonight, like what you see, please like, subscribe, rate, and review. I know every podcast says that, but it really does help the show out a lot. And we've also got some really cool new merchandise on our Fourth Wall store. A link for that will be in the description, so you can check that out. And if you want to go the extra step, be extra awesome, and be one of our Patreon subscribers, you can do that as well. Support the show for just a few bucks a month. I want to give a shout out to one of our Patreon supporters tonight, Aaron Hardy. Aaron, thank you so much. You are awesome. We really appreciate the support. And with that, before we get into our main topics, we are going to do, as always, our lightning round. This is where we just talk about some other things we're geeking out on. So, Andy, what are your picks for tonight as far as what else you're watching, listening to, etc.?
I'm going to abuse my opportunity here and shout out the X-Men Age of Revelation, the big crossover event that started last week and goes into full swing today with three or four miniseries starting. So I'm very excited about that. It's just starting, so I don't have a lot of thoughts other than I've been enjoying Jed McKay's writing on the Adjectiveless X-Men book so far. And he seems to be kind of the main author of the main story. And then everybody else is kind of doing their spinoffs and shoot-offs off that. So I think the core story will be good. I'm looking forward to that. I don't know. There are 17 different three-issue minis that are going on concurrently with this, which feels like an awful lot. I saw that eye roll, and I think that's appropriate. And but yeah, I think that means hopefully that there's something, a little bit of something for everybody. And yeah, I think the main story will be solid regardless. So looking forward to that.
Well, for listeners and viewers out there, if you ever need an encyclopedic knowledge of X-Men, Andy is your go-to expert there. And so if you want to know kind of like, oh, what, you know, with all these big crossovers going on and, you know, kind of where to start, what's a good jumping on point and, you know, which characters you might be interested in, Andy is your go-to here. So I love it. But yeah, we got to do another comic book catch up soon. We'll make that happen. But yeah. Awesome. Well, on my end, so I don't want to talk too much about Peacemaker because Christian and I did pretty in-depth last time on what's news, and we're going to be doing more on that because the season finale is this week, but I'm still loving it. If you checked out the last What's News episode, the theory that I shared, which is not, I don't credit that as my own, that was a popular fan theory, but it did come true in the most recent couple of episodes. And so, but I've really enjoyed just the storytelling throughout the season, and I'm very excited for the finale. So that's a big thing. And then the other is a little different from that, but another HBO show. So one of the great shows of all time that I'm only watching for the first time, but HBO's The Wire, which is critically hailed as one of the best shows, one of the best dramas of all time. But it came out when I was 9 or 10. So needless to say, I was not watching The Wire and Sopranos at that age. And so, some of the golden age of TV I'm watching much later on. So I know it's a, 20-year-old show, and I'm more than that. And I'm, just checking it out for the first time, only a few episodes in. But I'm very early on, but I see how intricate the storytelling is, how phenomenal the performances are. Andy, before we get live, we don't have to do a big discussion on this, but I'm just curious if that's one you ever watched.
It's funny. I was living in Baltimore when it came out, but really? I was living in Baltimore because I was going to graduate school. So I had the income of a graduate student, and that meant I did not have HBO. So is a hole in my golden age of TV awareness. But I probably should get around to checking that out because, like you say, it is one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, it's quite fantastic so far. And that's the thing. We didn't have HBO growing up. My parents weren't really into any of the HBO shows, so I got it much later. But yeah, so so one of mine very new, the other of mine is retro a little bit, but it's great. So yeah. Those are my lightning round picks, and with that, let's get on to the main topics for tonight. So okay, well, Andy, I'm very excited to hear from you about this one. I know very little about this movie other than I do know the director quite well, and then I know the co-screenwriter is a TV showrunner. And I'm a little familiar with the cast there, but tell me about this movie, The Lost Bus.
Yeah, so this is a film that had a limited theatrical release, but is mainly an Apple TV Plus jam. And it is based on the real events of what's known as the Camp Fire in California in, 2018, the most deadly wildfire in California. And destroyed the most number of buildings. Basically, the entire town of Paradise, California, was lost to the fire, and that's where most, if not all, the fatalities occurred as well. There were also some other surrounding towns that had significant losses as well in terms of homes and things. So, just a very devastating fire. And the film follows the story of a bus driver who happened to be in the right place or the wrong place at the right time, however you want to look at it, to pick up pick up kids from an elementary school that was being evacuated because it was closest to the edge of the advancing wildfire. And so he had to pick them up, and he thought he was picking them up to take them to a different elementary school in the same town where their parents would pick them up. But the fire was just spreading way faster than anybody anticipated. And so by the time he got to that school, at least as depicted in the film, that school was on fire itself and was on its way to being a total loss. Fortunately, that everybody had gotten out of there, but then they had to continue on through the town to get to another town called Chico, where everybody was being evacuated to from the entire town. But it's called the Lost Bus because the fire has disrupted communications. And so no one can tell him what's going on. He can't get any information. So he thought that they were just evacuating part of the town when he started off on this trip, and is just kind of having to make it up from there what to do once he realizes that that's not an option. So that's, so most of the film is, Matthew McConaughey, the bus driver, and America Ferrera, an elementary school teacher, and 20 some odd kids on a school bus trying to find their way through this rapidly expanding wildfire to safety. I apologize for the spoilers, but rest assured, it is not that kind of movie. The 22 children or so do make it out alive. So you don't have to worry about that kind of tragedy. But it is still an emotionally grueling film to watch just because of the tension and the drama. It's very well made. The craft of the visual and practical effects that went into creating the fire. They did a lot of things, they did a lot of just driving an actual bus around in actual, very safely done propane fires, to recreate the event. The acting is well done, the directing and the cinematography and the screenwriting and all that is all, very compelling. My biggest, issue with the film and, was that what I found compelling most about the story was he's constantly having to make these decisions. Do I go down this road? Do I go down that road? Do I stay here and wait a little while and see if the fire passes in in a different direction? Or do I move on because the fire is going to come here and I need to not be here? Right? There are several of those kinds of decisions that he has to make along the way. I think it captures well the uncertainty of having to make those kinds of decisions in that situation without complete information. And so I thought, maybe at the end we'll get a little bit of, if he had stayed here, that, this would happen, or if he'd gone this route, everybody that went that route, had other issues or whatever. But there was none of that, because it turns out that all of the drama inherent in that is entirely fictional. There was a bus driver with the name of Matthew McConaughey's character. There was a school bus full of children, but that's pretty much the start and the end of the reality of the story. And I know that they always have to embellish these things and dramatize these things to make it a compelling movie. But it's not just different; it's almost the opposite of what actually happened. What actually happened is he picked up the school bus full of kids. He continued to have contact. It's somewhat intermittent. There were disruptions to communications, but he wasn't completely out of contact with the bus depot. So he knew what was going on and where he needed to go. And he followed the established evacuation route. And anytime he tried to deviate from that, the law enforcement made sure that they stayed on the evacuation route, because that was the safe and effective route to get people out of town. And the movie is all about all of this, going off of that established evacuation route and, getting into all of these dilemmas because of that, and none of that happened. And it was just kind of frustrating that it almost feels like a dangerous kind of story to tell by deviating from reality in that way, because it's implying that, what you need to do is be this kind of cowboy loner, make your own kind of gut decisions about what to do and you'll be good. And when the reality of it was, no, we people have thought through these things and know what they're doing, and you need to take into account, awareness of the bigger picture and, go through those kinds of things. So yeah, I was just, I was very disappointed in that aspect of what I thought was a very well-made movie and had the opportunity to, get across a very good message about, fire safety and about climate change and all these things. And the heroism, shout out to, fire workers, EMS, all the people that actually deal with these things, definitely, just a heroic job, a selfless job, nothing, don't want to take anything away from them. And if anything, I felt like the movie could have done a better job of showing actual heroism of actual people. Not that the bus driver was an actual person, but his actions were completely different. And so, it undersells what he did, and it undersells, all the other jobs that other people were doing. So yeah, a very well-made movie. Just don't take away from it anything factual about the campfire, I would say, and you'll be in good shape.
There's a podcast or YouTube channel I watch called Real History that breaks down historical dramas, historical movies, and breaks down all the ones that are completely fictional, others that take some creative liberties to, like you said, to make it narratively compelling. But it's fascinating. I would like, this is a prime example of that, where you make a really good movie, but it does change the narrative completely. What I'm curious about, so I know the director Paul Greengrass from the Jason Bourne movies, and then Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks. So he's known for that very gritty, visceral, shaky camera work. Like, does he do the shaky handheld kind of camera work here, or is it a little more, is it different?
There is definitely some handheld, right? So there are times where they have to get off the bus, and so following them, you know, off of the bus and into different situations, you know, there is some of that kind of handheld camera. I wouldn't say it's as intense as the Bourne movies or things like that.
Sure.
But yeah, it's definitely got that same kind of style. And in fact, you know, so I was listening to an interview with him because I thought maybe he'd have more to say about like why they made the choice, the story choices that they did.
Yeah.
Didn't really get into that. It was more about the craft choices. But apparently for quite a while, he was intending to make this movie in a volume type setup with the big LED screens and a bus in the middle on a gimbal or something like that. And he thought that would be necessary for safety reasons and for other reasons. And, you know, so he was developing the film in that direction, and fairly shortly before filming started, decided to go in completely the opposite direction and, you know, go out into a lot. I mean, they weren't on, you know, they weren't necessarily out in the wild, so to speak. They were in a controlled setting, but still in a place where, you know, in a similar environment where the actual events took place, and, you know, creating real fires with gas. And then he talked about how, you know, doing it with gas pipes makes it safe because there's nothing that there's no particle matter that escapes from those fires that can spark other places. That's a big element of the film, is that these little sparks from a fire in one place are carried by very heavy winds, very long distances to start up additional spot fires that expand. And so that's part of why the fire moved so quickly and was so devastating, was just like it was constantly sort of leapfrogging ahead with these little sparks. And so they didn't want to obviously start their own wildfire making the movie, so they had to use these propane but if they use these propane fires, then they could do it safely. And so once he realized that there were ways to do it without creating another disaster, you know, by just making the film, they went with that realistic route. And he said, you know, that's more my style anyway. I don't know really why I was going this other direction. So yeah, it's definitely you know, it definitely feels like a Paul Greengrass film in that regard.
Well, and it's also an interesting combination here too, the screenwriter is being Greengrass, and then Brad Inglesby, who is the creator of Mayor of Easttown and Task, the new HBO miniseries. That fits. I mean, Inglesby has very, you know, these dark, gritty dramas. I think that lends itself to something that Greengrass would be attracted to. I think this sounds much more optimistic in that regard. Like, I think the, you know, Task and Mayor of Easttown are pretty depressing, but you know, this, I think what it sounds like a little more of an uplifting ending at the least, while still tense, you know, throughout the movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of the human element, yeah, it's certainly a very positive story about people making it through challenging times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will definitely check this one out. You know, on Apple, it's really interesting because I think they're still are dominated by some really good TV series, but the movies they put out, some are duds, but they, you know, they've started to attract more, you know, high profile filmmakers. So like I saw the Spike Lee one, Highest to Lowest. I actually got to see that in theaters, and I thought that was excellent. You know, and then, you know, they worked with Scorsese, and, you know, they're doing a lot of really interesting things. So they don't put out a ton of movies, but when they do, it's really interesting to see what it is. So yeah, this one is one I'll definitely check out. Like, I had seen something about it, but I honestly didn't know much about it, so I'm glad you gave me kind of the content, and I don't mind I'm that's a spoiler. I'm glad to have, knowing that the kids make it out, and it's a happy ending.
And it, you know, and it is real life, right? That, you know, that part of it is,
yeah, sure,
real. So
sure.
But yeah, I think
excellent.
I think that's good. If we want to move on,
great pick. Let's do it. Awesome.
Hey guys, Christian here to talk about our YouTube page. That's where you can go find us at youtube.com/@systematicgeekology. We have exclusive stuff there, exclusive videos where you can just hear other topics that you'll never hear on the podcast proper. These include things like comic book catch up, where we're discussing the newest comics that we're reading, Friday Night Frights, where Joe Day and I explore a cryptozoological, paranormal, ufological item of discussion. Has a lot of good fun there. Have a lot of great times with him. We have spontaneous YouTube shorts that we decided to do, a topic we wanted to discuss. They're in a very short form. We do them there as well. You can interact with us live as we're recording like a What's New episode or something like that. You have something you want to chime in? Well, how can you do it unless you head over to youtube.com/@systematicgeekology. All right, guys. See ya.
And so another movie for me. Now, this is a movie with a capital M. Oh my gosh, I just like it. But Andy, have you seen this one yet?
I was hoping to, but I could not get 3 hours in my weekend this past weekend. So maybe coming up, I've got a holiday extra day.
Sure. And I do understand that it's it's a 3-hour epic. Like, you do have to set aside some time for it. I will say off the bat that it does not feel like it's runtime. This feels more like, I would say, about a 2-hour movie. It flies by and it is so immersive. I'm going to refrain from giving really heavy spoilers. I'll set up the context, but I want as many people as possible to go to a theater and go see this movie, because for all the complaints of people say about, like, oh, film is dead, they never make original stuff anymore, that's a completely false statement. The problem is there are multiple problems there with, you know, there is the price of movies, there's, you know, the studio system, but the message is that if more audiences go out and see original films like this, it will send the message to studios to take more risks and let filmmakers do what they want. So I'll go ahead and say that as my, you know, TED talk of the day. But anyway, getting to the movie. So one battle after another, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, one of the great auteur filmmakers of our generation. And this movie, without getting heavy spoilers, is about ex-revolutionaries who, 16 years after they've been disbanded, their main nemesis, played by Sean Penn, returns, and Leonardo DiCaprio plays one of the ex-revolutionaries. The mother of his daughter went missing a long time ago. He's now been living incognito with his daughter. And when his daughter gets thrown into the mix here and gets captured, he has to go back into the fold, team up with other former allies, and, you know, go rescue his daughter, go on this part revenge, part, you know, reigniting revolutionary storyline. And based on that description alone, it doesn't sound like, okay, what's, you know, the main appeal there? It sounds kind of classic, like revenge, classic action movie. It is so much more than that. It is a big action epic. It is also a very timely satire that holds a mirror to our society right now, with political tensions, with, you know, rampant white supremacy, both in just, you know, social scenarios and in government. And it's not afraid to tackle those, all of those themes. And in particular, what this movie did for me, and this is one of its biggest references, it is also inspired by a Thomas Pynchon novel from the 90s, but one of its big influences that it directly references early on in the movie is a French film from, I think, the 60s called The Battle of Algiers, which I saw in a film class in high school, and it still left an impression on me, even just seeing it back then. It was something where I feel like that was one of the films that, you know, film students watch that really blurs the line between good and evil. There isn't this, like, definitive good guy, definitive bad guy. There's a lot of gray areas. And again, that was a heavy influence on this film, and the way it draws inspiration from there in terms of, you know, crafting these characters, crafting a villain who is so despicable and just so iconic that you can't help but be immersed in. You hate the guy that Sean Penn plays, but you're still transfixed by him, in the same way you are other great movie villains. Like, I'm thinking, you know, like Daniel Day-Lewis's character in Gangs of New York, the Butcher, Bill the Butcher, ones like that, you know, that, or pretty much anyone Ralph Fiennes plays. These, you know, great iconic movie villains that are so despicable, so terrifying, but you are just, you can't look away from. It has that kind of feel. DiCaprio gives a great performance. I think what really the, in addition to DiCaprio and Penn and, you know, the heavy hitters like this, Chase Infinity, who plays the daughter here, and I think this is her first big movie role, she really does amazing work here, carrying the heart and soul of the movie, because she is this next generation character who grew up without her mother. She knows that her dad was this ex-revolutionary, but you know, he's just kind of faded into suburban life now, and has, you know, done his best, but has very much struggled to adapt to being a civilian. And so she's kind of caught in this, in the middle of all this. But the way her character evolves and she kind of steps into the role that her parents laid out for her is fascinating to watch. there's just so much to absorb in this movie. I do want to see it again. It is also, yeah, because it's 3 hours, I've only gotten to see it once. I really want to go again this weekend because this is the kind of movie that demands to be seen on the big screen. It demands to be seen multiple times. It's really hard to take it all in on one screening. But there is just, I mean, yeah, I was laughing at points because it employs a very dark humor and very satirical lens. But then I'm also, you know, riveted by the drama, the spectacle, the originality. It's just, this is just such a phenomenal film from start to finish. Also, Benicio del Toro gives one of the greatest performances here as a very different character than what, you know, he plays typically very oddball characters. You look at even like The Last Jedi, like his role there, he kind of steals the show. Here, he does it as well, but with a more understated performance that we're not used to from him. And I thought that was fascinating. So there's just, you know, the cast is impeccable. The writing is superb. The directing is just, and the cinematography are just, I mean, I would say close to flawless. It's got a great soundtrack. I could go on and on about this movie. And again, I don't want to spoil things much because I really want people to go and see it. But Andy, what's kind of your background with Paul Thomas Anderson?
Good question. I've definitely seen some of his films, but not all of them. You know, he's somebody who I'm, you know, kind of aware of and, you know, pay attention when he's got a new film coming out. But I wouldn't say he's quite made my list of, if he's got a movie out, I have to go see it kind of thing. And that's not, that's not anything about the quality of the films necessarily. Just, I think some of them have flicked for me, or the subjects have flicked and others haven't. And so, yeah, but, he's obviously very talented.
Sure. And I haven't even seen all of his films either. There Will Be Blood is great. The Master, I think, has phenomenal performances. I love Licorice Pizza, Boogie Nights. But I think one of the fascinating things for me about Anderson is that his subject matter, I never know what he's going to tackle next. So Licorice Pizza, for instance, last film was this, Southern or the California, oddball relationship. And mainly the story of this young woman kind of like finding herself and as kind of idyllic tone to it. Then he does, The Master, which is, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character there is, while he's not named after the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, he's, a stand-in for that. It examines, cult ideologies. And then this, again, is a big action war epic and a satire. So while there are similar themes and kind of stylistic choices in all his films, and he does work with a lot of the same actors, I really love that his subject matter is kind of all over the place, and I never know what he's going to do next. There's a lot of originality there. And this especially, it's just, I was watching a review earlier on Chris Duckman's channel, which, by the way, he has a movie coming out soon, which I'm very excited for. But he was saying that this movie feels like it was, a late 90s, early 2000s, just auteur masterpiece that they, it's a cliche to say, oh, they don't make them like they used to. But there is a lot of truth in that because, like I said earlier, studios are very reluctant to greenlight anything that is not a big IP or that's not a safe bet and that, will turn a profit. And right now we need audiences to go out and support original 130 million films like this. We did it for Barbie and Oppenheimer. We can do it for this. And as someone who goes to the movies all the time, there are still plenty of original films being made, but they need support at the theatrical level. So if you can get to a theater, if you can go see this, please, I urge you, do not wait for streaming. I still need to see it again to really absorb it, and I'm sure I'll have more takeaways. But as it stands, I think it's just a phenomenally made, wonderfully acted film from start to finish. It is wildly entertaining and very provocative in terms of, again, how it holds a society, holds a mirror to society today, and has so many themes and talking points that you can't help but really break it down. And I ran into my creative writing professor from college on the way out of this movie, and we were talking about it. And, you know, it's just that kind of movie that really evokes discussion, because sometimes, you know, you see a movie and it's like, okay, you know, that was, you know, passing entertainment. This is the kind of film that really sticks with you in your mind and really moves you. So I cannot recommend it enough. I would love to discuss it more in depth with other hosts, because I think there is a lot of things here that could be tackled from a sociopolitical lens, from a spiritual lens. There's just a lot to dissect. So go see One Battle After Another. I can't guarantee it, but I think you will not be disappointed.
Excellent.
So there is my, so good movie discussion here. Andy, what is our next topic here?
Yeah, so, I think in the category of passing entertainment goes the Marvel Zombies animated series. And that's not a slight on the quality or what might get out of it, but I don't think it's going to go down with quite the same critical reputation as a Paul Thomas Anderson film. So this is the latest from Marvel, from the MCU, kind of expanding their animation offerings. It is very much a follow-up to the What If Season 1 episode in the zombie world. Right, so this is the same universe. So if you haven't watched that episode of What If, definitely go back and watch that. This is a 4-episode show, and that's essentially, episode 0 of this series. It follows several of our favorites from that first episode. The non-zombified heroes from that first episode are back, and then introduced us to more recent favorites who are also still not zombified in this world, and explores takes them on a story of that's sort of a tour of the world, and so you see different corners of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as they are zombified. We open in the same part of Lower Manhattan where the Battle of New York happens in the first Avengers film. And there's some very recognized, are familiar with that story, the architecture, the geography will be familiar there. It also features heavily in the Lego Avengers video game. Right, so I feel like I've gotten very familiar with that part of Manhattan just from those games. I have also been to that part of Manhattan, but I've not spent as much time there in real life as I have in those different properties. So we go there. We go to New Asgard in, is it Norway? We go to the Raft, and they do something interesting with the Raft prison, right? So, it's kind of a tour of MCU places, old and new, with MCU favorites, old and new. So in addition to the trio of Spider-Man, the floating head of Ant-Man, and, oh goodness, who was the third person from that first episode?
Was it, like, I know, well, Wanda is like the leader, but
Wanda becomes the zombified villain, she's the main antagonist in this. Apologies for blanking on let me see if the cast list is helping me remember, but no. So that trio from the first episode in from What If is joined by, as you can probably guess from the cast here, we've got the first episode of Marvel Zombies focuses on Iman Vellani's Ms. Marvel, Hailee Steinfeld, Hawkeye, and Dominic Thorne's Riri Williams. Right? So they're another trio that are traveling together, and they stumble upon what do they call it in the Spider-Verse movies? A thingy? No, not a thingy. A MacGuffin.
I watched it and I'm still like, I know it, we could just say MacGuffin at this point. They can come up with all the like terms they want. We're not going to remember them all.
Yeah. a doodad, a gizmo that they believe will contact the Nova Corps and summon the Nova Corps to help them cure the Earth of the zombie infection. And so that sets them on this story. But the problem is that the Earth has been covered in a an energy shield of sorts that is preventing transmissions from getting out. And there was an event in Wakanda, they call it, and that has caused the Earth to sort of be cut off from communication with the rest of the galaxy. So they have to find a spaceship and get into space to summon the Nova Corps. And I think that's probably all the plot we'll get into here. There's obviously more than that going on, as you might imagine, but a lot of it is just, you know, the thrills of seeing your favorites either, you know, in a new setting, or seeing your favorites as zombies, seeing, you know, various zombie kills and all that kind of stuff that comes with a zombie story. If you're into these characters and into this world, and you can tolerate that level of gore, and, you know, this is very much an R-rated or the equivalent thereof, kind of zombie story in animations, but still, you know, fairly intense. They do not shy away from the kinds of things that happen to zombies and that zombies do to other people in other kinds of zombie stories. If you like these actors, it's a lot of fun. I think that the thing that it highlighted for me, though, is just, you know, how many great characters are kind of sitting on the shelf of the MCU and we should really see more of, right? Simu Liu's Shang-Chi, debuted in an excellent film. And we've now seen him twice and Hilary Steinfeld twice, Hawkeye, in these animated shows, because they both had a What If episode, right? And some of these other characters that, you know, have been between What If and this, you know, we're seeing them on the small screen in animated form. But you've got some very charismatic, popular actors and characters that really should be, we should have had more films or something with some of these characters by now. And I know that there are a lot of reasons that nobody chose why that's happening, right? The strikes and the pandemic and all that. Like, this isn't all entirely just that they made bad decisions. It's also bad, you know, or unfortunate things happen to them and around them as well. But I think if they can find a way to keep folks around and get some of these folks into some more shows and movies, they have quite a lineup that is underutilized, let's say, thus far. And so it's got me excited. If they can do something good with them in Avengers Doomsday and Secret Wars, that would be great. Please, when Destin Daniel Cretton is done with Spider-Man Brand New Day, please make Shang-Chi 2, even though I'm sure they will want him back for Spider-Man whatever day, one more day, rainy day. Oh, there you go. Spider-Man Rainy Day. That's a crossover of Spider-Man and the Tom Holland Rihanna umbrella video. There's a billion-dollar idea, Marvel/Sony. You're welcome.
They're pitched right here. Hey, Spider-Man, die another day.
There you go. Tom Holland can just transition from playing Peter Parker to James Bond. There you go.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's the rights issues with Disney and Amazon, but who cares?
We're just throwing away the $1 billion right here.
Yeah, just do it. But yeah. No, I have similar thoughts. I mean, I've only watched the first episode of this so far, but I couldn't help but, you know, think while I was watching, similar thoughts as you, is like, I really wish we had seen these characters more. And I actually think they would have been better to have a lot of these characters introduced maybe in animated form at first. Like, I like watching that first episode, because I love Ms. Marvel, like the character, and particularly the Gio Wilson comics. And I just think it would have been so much better if they had introduced that character in an animated series that could have really captured the tone and aesthetic of those comics, then introduced her on live action form with the same actor, Iman Vellani, in, you know, the Marvels or whatever, kind of Captain Marvel sequel. That just would have, you know, been really cool. I feel like they are missing an opportunity here by not exploring animation more, because, you know, it cuts down on budget. There's the practicality of it, but also it's just a really good medium for storytelling, and they can do a lot more there on TV. So I kind of wish they had put more resources toward the animation beyond just What If and this, and done some of those live action shows that didn't succeed as well and done them in animated form. But just looking at the pilot, and again, I know I haven't watched the rest of it, it's entertaining. It is fun to see these characters. I'm a big zombie guy and I love horror. I don't think from that first episode it was like particularly leaned into it as much. I mean, you know, again, I haven't seen the rest, so it might delve into that a lot more. But it was, you know, is still perfectly entertaining. Again, it's just, it's hard to like not think about the wider MCU right now when I'm watching anything in this universe, because there is just so much, you know, it's so convoluted right now. And, you know, characters is kind of all over the place. And, you know, these, I like you, I loved the first Shang-Chi movie. I've been hammering for a sequel as well. And, you know, I hope they can also do more with characters like him and Ms. Marvel and Ironheart, all of these, you know, depending on how Doomsday and Secret Wars go, we will see. But yeah, I mean, this is a very enjoyable show on its own. Like, I remember doing a book club with the original Marvel Zombies comic years ago at the comic shop, and I actually was not a fan of it, even though I like Robert Kirkman and I love Walking Dead. Mainly the comics, the show is a little bit all over the place, but it was a great premise. I don't think that was executed that well. I'm glad that with the What If episode and this show, they took a very different storyline there and kind of made it their own, which I like. But yeah, I mean, I think the animation's solid. The other thing is that, you know, this is another thing of like, this just makes you really, it made me very just like sad about the overall state of the MCU. They have Blade in this, and it just reminded me that we're probably never getting the MCU Blade movie, because that has been stuck in development hell for years at this point. So that's just it. It's another thing. It's just like, I'm trying to watch these independently, but it's hard not to think about the wider universe and all the problems going on there. But this series, you know, if you want just some good, you know, zombie horror superhero entertainment, I think it scratches an itch there, and it has some fun characters. These are all characters that I really enjoy, and it puts them in fun interactions with each other. I will probably check out the rest of it, but it's also not like, oh my gosh, I have to watch this. It's high on my list. Feels, you know, kind of like you said, passive entertainment.
Yeah. And also, if they don't make that Young Avengers film they promised us at the end of the Marvels, I will be so sad.
Because, I mean, the chemistry between them here is flawless. Exactly. They've got all the ingredients there. They're missing so many opportunities. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But, I mean, I know, you know, Secret Wars is supposed to do sort of a soft reboot, and I agree that they need to scale back. I like James Gunn's approach in DC, that he's not greenlighting a project until he's happy with the script. That's a really good approach, I think. But nonetheless, they need to, you know, build on some of the promises that they've laid out. And, you know, all these are characters we haven't seen in forever. And yeah, just like, don't sit on these for too long, you know?
Yeah. And especially, you know, I especially think of Simu Liu, right? They made him an action hero star. And
yes.
Then, like, there's only so many years of a man's life that he can do that, or a woman.
Right. Right.
So don't, and yes, I know Liam Neeson, but right, he's not, everybody wants to be doing those kinds of films till they're 80. And so I think it's a real shame that, you know, this is 7 years of his kind of peak career for that kind of thing that have gone unused. So anyway, I'll get off my
I agree 100%. And yeah, not everyone can be a Liam Neeson or Tom Cruise, like, you know, like and again, the first Shang-Chi was so good. It was so well directed. It left me wanting more. I was just like, get this one a trilogy. And yeah, they have not followed up on that. So we'll see. But get on it, Marvel. We can, these are the things we want.
Yep. But
cool.
Howdy, guys. I really hate to interrupt, but my name's TJ, and I'm here to tell you about our new merch. We have incredible new stuff with Fourth Wall. We have just partnered with them as a new store. They have a lot more to offer, which means we have a lot more to offer. We can now offer you beautiful Comfort Colors t-shirts. They're so comfy. I wear mine all the time. And we've got it all now. Cups, hats, backpacks, pajamas. If you want your Systematic Geekology pajamas, you know where to go. My personal favorite is actually our Throne of Geeks shirt. It is Comfort Colors, you know, blue, black, green, red, orange. And the shirts are just so nice. And the shirt itself, we've got the Throne of Iron geeked out, because, you know, that's our brand. We've got Mjolnir on there, the Buster Sword, Trident. Basically, just the coolest weapons from our favorite properties are on the shirt, instead of a bunch of normal boring swords from the boring series Game of Thrones. So check that out, and thank you.
By contrast, somebody who knows how to strike while the iron is hot
someone who does not slow down, I will say. Right. So, yeah, for those of you who don't know systematic ecology, like I am kind of the right. I get the resident Swifty here. I don't know. There may be other hosts, but I'll have to see if we have any other McFans. But yeah, I mean, and I became a Swifty more in what kind of really kind of lured me. And I guess you could say is when she was on SNL a few years ago and did the 10 minute version of All Too Well. I was mesmerized there. I mean, I grew up, you know, like, I mean, I'd hear on the radio, obviously, you know, a rising cultural phenomenon throughout my lifetime. But I was not Tears of Tater by any means. I hadn't really gotten into that particular fandom, but that was what lured me in. And from that point on, I, you know, went all in. And I didn't get to see the Eras Tour live, unfortunately. I tried to get tickets, but I did go see the movie in theaters. And I went to with the new album, The Life of a Showgirl, I went to the movie release party for the album this weekend at Alamo. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, so this is obviously Taylor Swift's album, The Life of a Showgirl. A lot has happened, over the years with her career. And this is, a different tone because, the cliche around Taylor Swift is like, for a long time, was like, oh, she just, writes breakup albums and all that. And, that I think is a very like surface level thing to say. But nonetheless, there are a lot of her music for a long time was based on, evolving relationships and, her growing feelings and rise to fame. This one, it comes at a time where she's very happy and, she's recently engaged. She's at the top of her superstardom level. She's one of the most famous richest people on earth. And you wonder, how does that level of fame and fortune inform an artist's work? And I will go ahead and say, I mean, is this, my favorite album by her? No. Do I think it's terrible? No. I think it's, looking at it objectively as a fan, but as someone who can still, evaluate work on its own, I think it is I was texting a friend about it, and I feel like this came at the right time because, yes, it is a more happy, feel-good album, and it's not going to have the same, lyrical, hard-hitting kind of mastery as something like Folklore, Evermore, Tortured Poet Society, but it does have that kind of feel-good essence to it. And for me, at least, I needed something feel-good and happy and lighthearted. So I was happy to play this on Friday. I had a good time listening to it. I had a fun time at the movie, the movie was really just a compilation of lyric videos with intros by her. And then it showed the music video for The Fate of Ophelia, which is the first track on this album. And then it gave some behind the scenes into that. So it's more like a kind of a celebration, and she put it in theaters because she can, because she's Taylor Swift. But it was a fun time. But that's kind of was my reaction to this album. I mean, there are a couple songs I really like. There are others that are, it's not that good. But as a whole, it's an album that is very happy. It's very, to an extent, I think that when you do get that rich and that famous, yes, it's going to potentially have a negative impact on your work, because at a certain point, it's like, it's hard to relate to common people at all because you're on a whole nother stratosphere of fame and fortune. So there's going to be a difference in the songwriting here compared to her earlier works that are about just growing up in relationships and, trying to wrestle with different emotions. And, there's still the songs like Elizabeth Taylor and The Fate of Ophelia draw from her long time interest in English and mythology and literature. So that though very imbued in there. But some of the others kind of fall flat. And I mean, I'm not even getting through it on here, but there's already been a myriad of jokes about the song Wood on here, which is pretty obvious about Travis Kelce here, and has very sexual undertones to it. I did quite a laugh at a lot of the memes there. But yeah, so I mean, I give this a, you know, my Taylor Swift my favorite Taylor Swift albums are 1989, Red, and Midnight. I think all of those have different feels to them. They have really standout songs, and yeah, there's a good fusion of kind of pop and then, you know, Evermore and Folklore are very folk and have such strong lyricism. This is, you know, definitely not one of her all-time best, but again, I think it's a perfectly nice feel-good album, and I needed something like that with everything going on in the world right now. It was pleasant to get a nice, happy feel good album. So those were kind of my thoughts. Andy, I don't know. Are you into Taylor Swift at all? Or do you have like, is your family?
Right. So I've given Taylor Swift a lot of my money, but that is mainly to buy tickets to concerts for my daughter and my wife.
Sure.
So yes, I am certainly not a stranger to the larger Taylor Swift phenomenon. I've, you know, listened to most, if not all, of her music, including this album. You know, I gave it a once through because I, you know, I want to be able to talk to my daughter and my wife about these things that are important to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think I, for my own personal listening, enjoy Taylor Swift in her more pop mode, something like Midnight or you know, Lover or something like that. But you know, it's also not something I put, you know, Taylor Swift music is not something I generally put on for my own listening anyway. You know, I have a lot of respect for her as a musician, as an entertainer, as somebody who is taking control of her own destiny. I have no quarrels with any of that. And it's not a comment on the quality of it, any of the other things. It's just sort of not, it's obviously not for me, right? I am not the kind of person that she's thinking about when she's writing these songs, and that is A-okay. I'm glad that they are more meaningful to other people. My only other thought is, reaction to this album was that I do not envy my sister, who my daughter is now 18 or almost 19, all the way at college. She can make her own decisions about these kinds of things, but my sister, my niece is very much in that tween stage of life, and so, you know, navigating something like the song Wood, and whether we get to listen to it or not, and what it's talking about, I do not envy those conversations for my sister, but I'm happy to not have to deal with that myself at this stage in my relationship with my own kids.
I was texting my sister about that because my niece is 8 and, you know, I've been listening to Taylor Swift for years because, like, my sister plays in the radio and everything. So, I mean, she knows a lot of the classics, like, you know, Love Story and Shake It Off. And I mean, she knows a lot at this point, but I was texting about that. I was like, oh, are you going to let her listen to this album? Because that's, I can only imagine the questions that would come up there. But also on that note too, similar to what I was saying earlier about Paul Thomas Anderson and how the subject matter ranges here, I'm not saying there's not similar themes and subject matter, but I will say in terms of audience and how some song can be super mainstream, super appropriate for any age really, and great for young and older listeners alike. She can also do stuff that is very mature and that is intended for an older audience. That's okay. And because she has such a massive I'm drawing a blank on the word, but like, because I was about to say filmography, but a massive library of songs and albums there, you know, you can, if you want to just let your kids listen to Fearless and 1989 and stuff like that, that's totally fine. And then, you know, when they get older, they can listen to Tortured Poet Society and Life of a Showgirl. So that there is that, it's okay that I think an artist can evolve and can kind of grow with their audience and still have plenty to offer younger and older audiences alike. But yeah.
Sounds good.
Very cool. So that is my thoughts there. I love how this episode, I feel like this episode of What's News, we really got to talk to multiple audiences here, multiple fandoms, because a lot of times it's like, oh, we're going to talk about the latest comic book material, and that's pretty much it. We cover a lot of material here. And Andy, before we go, let's also look to the rest of the year, because there is some exciting movies, TV shows, other fandom items coming up. So, Andy, if there's like a few projects here that it's we're in October of 2025 right now. Got a little bit left of the year. What are you most looking forward to the rest of the year?
Yeah, so real quickly, unlike Paul Thomas Anderson, both Edgar Wright and Rian Johnson are on my list of if they've got a movie, I'm going to see it. I am very excited for Running Man and Wake Up Dead Man. I wasn't sure about Last Night in Soho, like going into it, and I was really impressed with that film. So even though like the Running Man, the story hasn't grabbed me in the past, I'm very excited to see what Edgar Wright does with that. Partly because of his work on Shang-Chi, and partly because I'm curious about the tone and the story. I am excited for the Wonder Man show that Destin Daniel Cretton has been overseeing. And our family has, they are, you know, silly and goofy, but our family has really gotten into the Now You See Me films. So I'm looking forward. I'm hoping that it will still be in theaters when both of my kids get back from college so that we can go as a family to see that, to see the latest and appropriately named Now You See Me, Now You Don't.
I love it. Yeah. Same as you, Rian Johnson, Edgar Wright, two of my favorite filmmakers. I'm very excited for. I got to see I've seen both Knives Out movies in theaters because the last one they also did, once Netflix bought it, you know, they did the limited theatrical release. I'm definitely going to do that again for Wake Up Dead Man. Running Man, I'm there opening night. I love Edgar Wright, one of my all time favorite directors. And easily the top two I'm most excited for, though. Unsurprisingly, if this is your first time listening, then you know you'll learn this about me. If you've listened to this show at all, you will know that Wicked and Stranger Things, the final season, are the biggest. You know, I got my tickets for Wicked today. Stranger Things season 5, the final season. I've been there since day one. I've been rewatching the whole series again in anticipation. So I cannot be more excited for both of those projects. Wonder Man, I'm very interested. Now I did not know that Destin Daniel Cretton is overseeing it. That's really exciting to me. I really know nothing about that character, but that just it skyrocketed my excitement level. So that is really good to know. Avatar, I mean, I'll see it. It's one of those, like, you know, I remember when the first one came out, it was mesmerizing, especially from a visual lens. And, you know, the last movie felt like very visual spectacle as well. I can't say I really have high expectations for the narrative, but yeah, I mean, I'll go see it. But definitely Stranger Things and Wicked are the biggest excitement levels for me. And Tron, I would be more excited for it if Jared Leto wasn't in it. I'll leave it at that.
I hear you.
So yeah, but some good stuff coming out. I'm really excited. I think, you know, we'll still have plenty more to talk about before the year ends, and a lot of big spectacle movies and shows and smaller stuff as well. And again, it's Halloween season, so it's my favorite time of year. Very excited for all the horror stuff. Oh, that's the other thing. Oh, Welcome to Derry is coming out at the end of this month. That's it prequel series that I'm really hoping will be good. Awesome. Well, Andy, this has been fantastic. And before we go, do you have a recommendation either from anything we've talked about tonight or something else you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, it's a good question because I have mixed feelings about both of the things that I talked about, as I think was obvious. I'm tempted to just sight unseen recommend one bed after another based on your raves, and you know I am excited to see it, just haven't gotten the chance yet. So maybe I suspect to join you in picking that one.
I will. Yeah, that is definitely my pick. I mean, unsurprisingly, after my rave review, but also you know if you've not seen any other Paul Thomas Anderson films, like, go check out some, either, you know, rent them or I'm always a big fan of, you know, physical media. So, you know, if you want to go out and get some Blu-rays. But if I want to recommend one in particular, been a while since I've seen it, but Punch Drunk Love is a phenomenal one. Like, I mean, this was long before Uncut Gems. I think Adam Sandler has always been a great actor. He's just like, he can do amazing things. And I mean, I love his, you know, 90s comedies, but as far as showing what he can really do as a performer, he can do amazing things when he's paired with the right script and the right director. And that's a perfect example of that.
Yeah. It's a little off our beaten track, but while we're making a plug for going to see movies in the theater, I will also make a plug to go see theater in the theater. I, it, won't be available to everyone, obviously, but I went with my wife to see Noises Off in Pittsburgh here on the stage.
Okay.
It is a, you know, farce play, you know, lots of in and out of doors, lots of, you know, goofy physical comedy, and just had a really great time, an excellent performance. A lot of goes into the timing of a show like that, getting all the different movements and cues and everything right. So yeah, shout out to the cast of Pittsburgh Public Theater's performance of Noises Off, and you probably can't go see it, but there's probably some other live theater near you that you can go see, so look into that as well. And if you want something geeky,
I was about to say,
Keanu Reeves and Alex Winters will be on the stage in New York in Waiting for Godot if you need a geek book to your theater outing.
I would love to get to New York to see that one. It's like that, and then the one I really want to see is the Stranger Things, sure. The first Shadow. Yeah. I mean, I've been in New York a couple times. I love it. But next time I make it out there, that's on my list. But yeah, but definitely, I mean, but live theater, 100% endorse. I have a theater background, and you know, and this does not have to be exclusive to Broadway. Go see shows in your community, support live theater. Absolutely. Awesome. Well, Andy, this has been fantastic. I love how many, how many things we covered tonight. We tackled a lot of different fandoms, and this was a ton of fun. So thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Thanks for having this chat with me.
Absolutely. And again, for our listeners out there, viewers, if you're on YouTube, please like this. If we get 50 likes on any one of our videos, our very own Will Rose will, he'll do something. We keep changing what his promise will be. It's been everything from frolicking through a field of flowers to maybe he'll show off his Halloween costume. I don't know. We'll do something fun, but please hit that like button. It really helps. And wherever you are on listening to this, any kind of support really helps the show. And again, you can check out our merchandise. You can connect with us on social media. We really appreciate your support. And just remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of peace. Take care, everyone.
Hello there, listener. This is Evan Garcia, and I just wanted to jump in here to remind you and to let you know of our Facebook groups and our Discord server. These are great communities where you can post and share memes and talk with the hosts, and we have votes and some polls for future episode topics and fun interactions with our hosts. So just wanted to remind you that we are focused on community with you listeners, and we love each and every one of you guys listening. Thank you guys.
Hi friends, it's Laura here, and I just wanted to say thank you for listening to our show. Systematic Geekology is a part of a larger podcast network called the Anazal Podcast Network. Dummy for Theology is Joshua Noel's show discussing different theological topics from various perspectives and attempting to give people more questions than answers. My Seminary Life is Brandon Knight's show. It started as him going through what he was learning in seminary, and after he graduated, he's been doing independent studies and has a lot of fun series like on hermeneutics, Bonhoeffer Summer, and worship. And then Friday Night Frights is a monthly show with Christian Ashley and Joe Day. They have a vote on the Systematic Geekology Facebook group to choose a topic each month and discuss everything from cryptos to ghosts to aliens to serial killers and more. So we hope you'll give it a listen, and thanks for being part of what we're putting out there.